Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another Science Studio program. Today we're going to be talking about organization. Organization, in a sense, if there's a big problem out there in society, in particular we're going to talk about obesity, how do we tackle that as a society? What sort of organizations do we have to sort of institute in order to sort of rid ourselves of the specter of more and more obese people, including our own families? We're going to be talking to the Assistant Director of the Global Obesity Prevention Center at the famous Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore. Her name is Dr. Anne McDermott, and Anne, welcome to Science Studio. Before we get into global sort of initiatives and obesity and health problems in general and how to tackle them in an organized sense, apart from just patients going to see doctors, how did you get into the business of being in this type of area of science and health?
Okay. Well, I've divided my life up into phases, and I'm a first-generation college grad, a first-generation native English speaker. My parents, from the time I was a little kid, always told me my brothers and I would be going to college, always said how we were the next generation that would be the solution. So there's a tremendous amount of faith in my brothers and I, and that everything we were doing, we were going to try different things. We were in music and sports and activities and just all kinds of exposures.
Is that an overachieving family, do you think?
No. There was nothing about it wasn't about excellence and performance. It was about exposure. In fact, my parents hardly ever came to any activity. I was in a youth symphony. I found out about myself.
They just wanted time to themselves.
No, they were working. They were busy working. They were both working multiple jobs. And it was either that or come home alone. But it wasn't the way it was framed. It was really about, you need to try this. You need to try that. What else do you want to try? And it was about the belonging and the trying.
And where was this? And where did your parents come from?
My parents were born right when my grandparents arrived from Lithuania. And they didn't speak English until they went to school. And it was the school system that taught them to speak English. And I was in a multi-generational home. I had my grandmother and my uncle living with us and my brothers and my father in a small apartment and my other grandmother and my other uncles living down 1 mile away. So there was a lot about family and all. But school, I always loved school. I couldn't wait for the summer to end. I was the weird little kid. But I couldn't wait for the summer to end to get back to school. And I did well in school.
It's usually the people who do well that can't wait for it to start.
Yeah,
there are others
yeah.
that just dread the beginning.
Yeah. I loved my friends. I had a wide circle of friends. I wasn't like in an in crowd. I'm a chameleon. Right. You can throw me in a room with people and of any group and I'm fine.
So, but then where does the science come into this?
It didn't until I had a high school teacher that encouraged me to look beyond just a state school because we had no money. And so she took me under her wing just a little teeny bit to say to me, apply bigger and better and let them reject you. Don't worry if they reject you. Just try. I got a scholarship to Boston University, and I was in nursing school. I really didn't like it. It was in way over my head. I did horribly in the sciences because I was in a very poor high school. I didn't have the background and the exposure that the other kids had. So when the teacher said, when we're going to have the first month of review, within the first week we had covered everything I learned in high school. And so it was a big, big struggle. And I made it through 3 years of nursing school. I did a year in the hospitals.
So you got very close to the end.
I did. But it didn't – I say it didn't make my heart sing. It was a job to me, and I did it. But it didn't give me joy when I was doing it. It was one Sunday night I thought, oh, my gosh. Tomorrow's clinic, I'm going back to work.
So it was the people, the patients that you had to interact with?
It
because
was
you'd got
job.
By then all of the academic
yes,
chores
the academics
out the way.
Were over. And, nursing was in a different phase at that point. It was paid much lower. You had to do a week of days, a week of evenings, a week of nights. My body clock didn't work like that at all. People talked down to you. It was a woman's field, and the doctors were horrific. It was insulting, and I couldn't bear to watch these wonderful, committed nurses spoken to so poorly by residents and never mind just doctors.
That still happens to a certain extent.
So I knew it was something about health, but it wasn't that nursing thing. Oh, and by the way, when I was in high school, I did always well in exams to show skill and capacity in sciences and math. All anyone ever said to me is, you should be a teacher or a nurse. My neighbor said I should be a meter maid because I did I loved being outside and running. And so she said, well, you'd get to work then all the time and be outside and move around. So
well,
there was
okay,
nobody.
Outside in Boston in the winter is not
oh
quite
my gosh,
the same as
yeah.
outside in the winter
but
in El
no
Paso.
One was, there was no outside person saying to me, oh, you, right. should be, you, know, you should be going on to these advanced degrees. You should be moving forward. So I did go through. I switched into education in my senior year, and I took a year and a half to finish. And I loved it. I taught in the Boston Public Schools for 11 years. And then, but I knew it was not, it was good. It was good for then, but it was not a good forever. I had gone back at night to get my master's degree in athletic training in cardiovascular health and exercise. I still loved that exercise, health, nutrition, healthy behavior thing and disease. What disease prevention? And then I moved to the college level. So with 32, I switched over to working at a Boston University, and I was running programming on health and education for the university. It's a 25,000 person full-time student university, so it's big
right.
for the faculty and the students. I ran facilities, decided what PE programs were going to be run for the university in
do
certain
all
divisions.
Do all students in those days have to do any PE?
They didn't have to, except for certain majors,
right.
certain health.
But the chemistry students went out there.
But
doing
I'll tell
push-ups.
You, they were the faculty and the staff all took advantage of the classes. We had wonderful classes with a lot of attendance. Faculty in the class with the students,
yeah.
they were quite popular. And
did you get a sort of a feeling that that meant that these faculty up there were a little healthier than they were in, say, in Boston College, where maybe they didn't do this?
I was really struck by how committed the faculty and students didn't see differences by age or whatever. They were just a community that wanted to be healthy together.
Yeah.
Like the faculty weren't saying, can you provide us faculty classes
no,
to
no,
do this
no.
thing? So I did
so you did that for how many years?
Well, I was – and then I was coaching men's and women's swimming, college
right.
swimming. And then
well, – you've had a lot of different careers.
Yeah. So that's my 30s college level. I went to a university. I got wooed away to build a new program for a swim team and PE and fitness and community stuff for a university that had a new fitness center. So my 30s were in college health and fitness stuff. And then at 40, I said, I want to go back for my doctorate. And luckily, I have a very wonderful husband. He said, okay. And then they told me I couldn't go back without repeating all my chemistries and everything because chemistry had changed so much since I had done my undergrad. So I had to take a year of organic with a lab, inorganic biochemistry, did that. And at 42, I went back for my doctorate at Tufts University School of Nutrition Science and Policy.
Wow. And how long did it take you?
I did a seven-year doctorate because I was in human subjects. And
okay,
so
right.
the kind of doctorates that involve human subjects, it takes longer to recruit them, longer to run the interventions and studies.
There's an interesting question that comes up. I mean, it's one thing to start doing a doctorate at, say, 21, 22. And then, you know, you're at the beginning of a career. You have an established house, marriage,
mm-hmm,
children,
mm-hmm.
and all the rest of this stuff. And there you are now at 42, and you're looking for a seven-year program.
Yeah.
Did you get paid for this? You had fellowships and all the rest of it?
I actually got a
TA?
Scholarship.
Okay.
And
for 7 years?
Yeah.
Well, that's pretty good.
Yeah. And so the scholarship meant that I was a research assistant in a laboratory.
Right.
And I worked on a number of projects. But the other thing, too, I said I love school. I actually took double the course load that I needed because I wanted to learn about the policy side.
You're the sort of student out of the students hate. All right, taking more than you need.
But
so
I,
policy was something that you began
I
to think
knew
about.
That, yeah,
right.
I knew that it was more than the individual. It was more than the individual's behavior, and it was more than the individual's physiology or makeup or whatever, genetics. And
it's a societal issue.
It's big. And then it goes on because as I was finishing, my mentor said to me, well, what are you doing for your postdoc?
I said, yeah, retiring, for God's sake.
I said, I need to get out and work before I retire.
great.
And so I said, and what are you thinking? Because I knew he had something on his mind. And he said, I think you need to do a postdoc in genetics and obesity science because everybody thinks it's genetics. So as I was doing this, all this training, though, I knew I wanted to run, like to build a new kind of a center, a new kind of a system.
You wanted to be in charge.
I want to be the boss.
Okay.
I'm the queen bee.
All right. Okay, so then you did a postdoc in the genetics of obesity, et cetera, et cetera. And then you came to the concept of, I want to help run a center that does this the proper way. And that, maybe not directly, but that gets you into the position you are now.
Yeah.
Assistant Director of a Global Obesity Prevention Center at Johns Hopkins. What is a Global Obesity Prevention Center?
Okay. So we are a very special, specific type of obesity center. And at this point, we're the only one of its kind in the world. And we're a system science center. And so we believe that the cause and the solutions are complex, that they involve many facets, and that there is a role for physiology and biology and genetics and all, but there's also a role for individual behavior, family behavior, community behavior, the environment we live in, and the policies that support or promote certain healthful behaviors or unhealthful behaviors. So to solve the problem or to find solutions, we need to bring everybody to the table, and we need to have a common language, and we need to find strategies that work for specific populations because we are not all alike. One size does not fit all.
Let's throw out a sort of a question that might seem silly. Does it make any difference that we're getting more and more obese people? Or we may become an obese race.
So
what's the ultimate negative apart from you wouldn't want to be it yourself?
Well,
but
besides just the race part on that, and then we see it in the United States, we're like 20 years ahead of the rest of the world. So every time we see something in the United States a few years behind us, a few steps behind us, we know what's going to happen in the other developed nations and also in the other developing nations.
They used to say that about California. California does this and the rest of the U.S.
Yep.
I don't think obesity is a particularly big problem in California.
It is by pocket. So California is a huge state, like Texas is a huge state. And because it's a long state, you know, it runs, I'm going to say on the East Coast, the equivalent would be like running from Rhode Island to Florida Keys. And so we have very many pockets of populations in there. I was out for my previous job, the one right before the Hopkins job, I was out in California in the Central Coast. And we had one type of population in challenges in our community, but if we went over the mountain to the Central Valley, totally different population, totally different set of issues and statistics. United States has a tendency to lump all our, on average, we are this. Well, we have a lot of noise around the average, and we have extremes that are healthy, and we have extremes that are particularly unhealthy.
But it's becoming easier these days to tease out those pockets of diversity, if you like.
We do that in some sense. There is still a hold in the traditional science, the traditional research that finds it most comforting to lump everything together and give averages and means and medians and all that. But the particular type of research that I do is community-based participatory research, which means that at that table of all those experts that we talked about before includes the community themselves, because who knows better about life in the community than the community person?
That's exactly right, and we'll come and deal with that after a short break. This is Keith Pannell talking with Dr. Anne McDermott from the Global Obesity Prevention Center at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore, Maryland. We'll be back in one moment.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog.
And I'm Dr. David Niesel. Hey, Norbert, what are the differences between men and women?
Are you kidding? We can't tackle that in one episode.
Well, we won't be that ambitious. We're looking at how men and women respond differently to prescription drugs, and yet they're given the same doses.
True. Take a recent case. The FDA required that the sleep aid Lunesta starting dose be reduced from 2 to 1 milligram because women stay drowsy far longer than men. It posed a safety risk for women driving and working.
The one-size-fits-all approach can't be practical when men and women are obviously physiologically different. So why are drugs developed this way?
From basic studies in biomedical science where cell lines are used to experimental animals such as lab mice, they're mostly male. The majority of clinical trials involving humans enroll men.
How did this situation occur? For many years, women weren't included in trials because of concerns they were pregnant or would become pregnant. Their hormones alter metabolism or interact with drugs. Their gastrointestinal absorption rate is different, which alters drug levels in the blood.
We've also learned the female kidney's glomerular filtration is slower at clearing drugs compared to men. Aspirin is less effective at lowering subsequent heart attacks in women, and beta blockers also work differently.
All this made researchers avoid women to lessen the complexity of their drug trials. To change that, studies are now required to represent both genders. This may add to the cost of drug development, but it is a necessity.
We are Drs. David Niesel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries shape the future of medicine. For much more and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell, Dr. Anne McDermott from the Global Obesity Prevention Center at Johns Hopkins. And we were just talking about your sort of initiative, what this prevention center is. And your last comment was just so sensible. Who knows how best to deal with the community than the community itself if given the proper guidance, of course.
True.
So tell us what's happening at the prevention center.
So at our prevention center, as I mentioned, we're a system science center. And so in addition to the usual people at the table, the nutrition people, the health people, the exercise physiologist or the psychologist or behaviorists, we have a whole division that is primarily engineering trained and modeling. And the modelers have the ability to design and create predictive models that can explain the potential future path. So, for example, when an epidemic or a pandemic breaks out, and bird flu, Ebola, or whatever, the modelers come in and start figuring, okay, if at this rate, if it's not stopped, what's the amplification rate going to be? Are there certain areas that we should be more concerned about? Or if we want to identify the nexus, where did this thing start? What is the origination? So we can go retrospectively and look. Modelers have skill sets and strategies and tools that they use, mathematical tools, to determine both the retrospective history and the progressive potential future without intervention, or they can actually model impact. So you could say, we want to put a soda tax in. Should it be 5 cents? 7 cents or 10 cents on a unit. And then they can model out the impact of each of those things to see if there's a threshold. If you do the 5 cents, it'll be get you the same thing as if you do the 10 cents. So that center is really focused on this new way of combining skills, combining expertise, and then using the models to help.
So
direct.
This isn't simply interdisciplinary. This is
multi-disciplinary. Oh, this is multi. And this is new people to the table.
So the very fact, I mean, this is really quite interesting because if you're bringing in the people who use mathematical approaches to past analysis, future prediction, then in a sense it seems to me you've got the capacity to do a big experiment in the sense that you take a particular population which is similar in all respects.
Yes.
But in one, you leave it alone.
Yes.
And in the other, you do your interventions, collect data, and then there's got to be an outcome, which otherwise you won't really get funding for very long unless you have outcomes.
Yeah.
Are you doing that type of comparison
population?
So
we have a virtual Baltimore population that we're working on creating. And so those models create on some of the different tools include agent-based models, which are things like you have choices. Do you choose dessert? Do you not choose dessert? And so you're an agent and you can have these different decisions throughout the day. They also do social networking models, which says if my family does something, how much do we influence our neighbors? And or if we were going to have a campaign, would it be best to have a health campaign address a specific school, or should we address all schools at the same time, or should we do it statewide? So they have a different – they have all these different suites of tools. The Baltimore model, the Virtual Baltimore Laboratory, we are collecting real data on agents and the human beings in the community, families, kids, local stores – the vendors, the
by data, you mean what are they eating and how often, and what exercise do they get and how often?
It depends on the question that the group is looking for at that moment. So right now, for example, it would be what a local store is selling, how many times a day does a kid come into the store, what makes a child choose one corner store over another corner store? Is it location? Is it where your friends hang out? Is it proximity to home? Is it proximity
so this is
to
really
school?
Getting away from the direct diet as to the social fabric of this environment.
Well, we know the social fabric influences what you right. eat and yes. where you eat. And so, for example, teenagers might forage. So as a group, I might not be hungry. My gang, my group wants to go to the local store to get some food. Well, I'm going to go with you. The odds are I'm now going to get right. whatever you're getting to.
The social pressure on obesity. I mean, when you meet somebody who is obese, there's two things that you think. One is, boy, why didn't they have more discipline? And mm-hmm. I suppose that's a terribly negative stereotype that I would have.
Very common.
And the other is, you know, what sort of genetic predisposition and health feature, disease feature that you have.
Okay.
Now, when you have your smaller societies and obesity is becoming more and more popular, at the beginning I suspect that people would look at the obese person with at a certain distance and not feel comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
But as more and more, then maybe it's the other way around. They start looking at this flacco, this thin person, and thinking, what's the matter with this guy?
So the social norm is definitely different. I ask – when I teach classes at the college level, I ask students to go get one of the early James Bond movies. And I want you to – because a James Bond movie tells you about the social norms. What's a beautiful woman? What's a handsome man? And look at their physiques – look at their clothing. So, for example, in a James Bond movie, Top Job is a big guy. I want you to go into the web or go – I'm not going to tell you the answer. Go look at a picture of Top Job and see just how obese he is. It's all relative.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Look, I mean, it's a societal problem in the sense that, you know, you could say, well, why does anybody care? Well, one of the reasons I
ching
guess
ching. It's dollars. It's
well, yeah, precisely, because if people are obese, they get sick, and then someone's got to look after them, and given the way the health system is, that's going to be all of us. I mean, that's one key feature. And so government has a role in funding your operation, I'm sure. Does it have a role in telling people what to eat? I mean, the mayor of New York, Bloomberg, started to say, well, you can't sell drinks that are
yes.
greater than, I don't know what the volume was, but these gigantic drinks. You shouldn't be able to sell those anymore. And, of course, that got a sort of a kickback. People said, well, who the hell is the government? And Mayor Bloomberg, with his millions, to tell me what I can spend my $5 drink.
Yep.
But I would think government should have a role in this somehow.
The opposite. So that's kind of a paternalistic approach on the Bloomberg approach, and where Bloomberg and his cabinet have made a decision as to what would improve the health of the city. On the other hand, Berkeley passed a soda tax, and overwhelmingly passed a soda tax, and that was a vote before the city.
Berkeley, California?
Berkeley, California.
All right.
So here's an example, though, where the community became an informed community. They could weigh the pros and cons as to how it would affect their lives.
It was rather like the cigarette tax.
Exactly.
The same concept.
Exactly. And so the choice was made to tax the sodas in that city. That's the voice of the people in that case. So the people have chosen that. The business.
This is you know, like a six pack of soda as well, or
any
or just
soda,
fountain sodas.
I don't know the details.
Because I mean, obviously, it's going to be like Texas, which has all these counties, dry, wet, dry,
yeah,
wet.
Yeah.
But they're very convenient that every dry county has a wet county next
to it, yeah.
So you can go and get whatever you
yeah.
need.
I don't know, and on that, I don't know the details of the Berkeley right. one.
But it's another intercession of government.
Exactly. Yeah, this is a selected by the people. This is a selected influence of government. So one of the things, back to the Virtual Baltimore Laboratory, one of the things that we're interested in is when a community makes a decision about, say, a tax or some kind of a financial either incentive or a penalty. Not only how does that affect you, the individual living in the community, how does that affect the store owner and the vendor, because they are your community members? How does that affect the outlying community? Have we now forced them to go to the surrounding community so the dollars leave your local community? But it's complicated, and so it means taking a wider perspective lens than we traditionally have. Usually it's change your food, don't change anything else. Change your exercise, don't change anything else. And now we're saying every action has intended or unintended consequences, short-term and long-term implications, local and global implications, and we need to be looking at all of those at the same time.
What's the outcome, Anne? I mean, you know, at some stage when you get funding from local governments, universities, federal governments, they're going to want, and I think it's appropriate, some form of outcome.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what do you see as an outcome after 5 years, for example?
So, well, we have outcomes for our center, and then we have outcomes for the work that we do. So our center has been funded by the NIH, and it's in partnership with the NIH, our university, and it was designed for 5 years to be a launching grant. And we are supposed to create this team, create this research center, find collaborators throughout the nation or the globe and other universities or governments and all, and then position ourselves so that we are appealing to other funding sources, be it foundations and personal money or other governments.
So this initial outcome is the setting up of the center.
Yeah, we have to be stable house.
The gathering of partners.
Exactly.
With deep pockets, if you're lucky.
Yeah. So okay. This is a new business model
right.
in obesity. So first of all, get your house set and get your house stable.
Right.
And then now that you have this big team in your business.
Open the doors and let your people roam.
Exactly.
Which brings me to the global aspect.
Yes.
Okay. I mean, I can see the local virtual, you know, population mm-hmm. of Baltimore. Global. Give us some examples of where you have a global reach.
Okay. So right now, the virtual Baltimore laboratory is the preliminary model. So we will collect real data, and we have census data and stores and all this besides individual data, and they will develop these models. Well, then the next thing would be maybe to go to Mexico City and take that model to Mexico City. And we say, okay, these are the variables we need from you, Mexico. We need to know your census information or whatever it is. And then we could plug those in and change the numbers within the model and run the model. If our model truly is predictive, we should be able to help
another city. I mean, you mentioned Mexico because it's well understood that Hispanics have a genetic predisposition to get, for example, obesity.
And diabetes and all the comorbidities.
What about when you go to somewhere where or a location where you think Thailand, for example, where everybody looks extraordinarily thin, is there evidence that obesity is spreading into these other types of society?
Absolutely, absolutely. Even in Africa, what's happening is there still remains in many of these, in the underserved communities or undeveloped nations, there still remains a population of at risk for micronutrients like vitamins and minerals, at risk for calories and macronutrients, but now there's a subset. So we have a diverse population that's spreading apart from each other, overfeeding, overeating, and all that is growing. So even in Asia, big time problems.
So I'd like to thank Anne McDermott for being here on Science Studio. Anne is the Assistant Director of the Global Obesity Prevention Center in Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore, Maryland. Thank you so much for being here, Anne. It's been a great
pleasure. It's been
pleasure.
A pleasure.
Thank you for listening out there, and we'll be back next week with another Science Studio covering who knows what. So you be there. Bye-bye.
I'm Noemi Rojas with your Synapse Flash. The Medical Center of the Americas Foundation recently purchased a 13-acre parcel from the city at Gateway East near the Reynolds exit. It is there that the foundation will build a $29 million biomedical innovation center called the Cardwell Collaborative. Prep work of the land has already begun. Groundbreaking is expected in January. Read more at mcasynapse.org.